Brothers in the Dharma, thank you, Padmadaka, for that brief introduction. Thank you. It was quite a long applause, and I haven't even started speaking yet. So, we'll see how long it is at the end, won't we? So it's a little bit of a hard act to follow when you get a welcome like that. I must say, I'm really thrilled to be not just giving some talks on this Order Weekend, but actually being on the Order Weekend. I don't know why it is, because, you know, living here, I'm on just about every National Order Weekend. But just sitting in the lounge this evening and seeing everybody come in and just looking at people and seeing people connect with one another and connecting with various people, I just felt so uplifted, just so happy to be with such a big gathering of Order members. And to see, you know, old and new friends. I mean, some people I haven't seen for quite a long time. And I just feel so uplifted by it. Quite, well, not exactly overcome, but going in that direction. So, already I'm having a very, very good time. If we stopped here, I would have had a good weekend. But we're not going to stop here. So I'm going to start by reading you the verses of acceptance. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So these are the verses of acceptance that are recited towards the end of the public ordination ceremony. Everybody here has recited those verses. They represent the spirit in which ordination into the Western Buddhist Order, Trailokya Bada Mahasangha, is given and received. The spirit in which ordination is given and received. And I think you can appreciate how weighty they sound. Whenever I recite them, they seem very weighty indeed. Although they're very simple, perhaps because of their simplicity, they have a weight, a profundity even, a beauty even. They even seem to have a sort of vow-like quality to them. As if in saying them, we are vowing to be loyal to our teachers, vowing to be in harmony with our friends, vowing to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And over the last few years, I've become more keenly aware of these verses of acceptance. I've become aware of them through performing a number of public ordinations. It's a very, very great privilege, a very, very great honour, being able to perform public ordinations. And one of the effects of performing public ordinations is getting to know the public ordination ceremony quite well. You become aware of its different elements, and that prompts you to reflect on the nature of ordination and on the nature of what it means to be an order member. Perhaps one day we might even devote an order weekend to all the different elements that make up the ordination ceremony, and see what meaning they can give to our lives. Obviously, there's the recitation of the refuges and precepts. That's well known. But what does the making of offerings symbolise? What does that really mean? What does the purification with the water from the initiation vase really mean? What does the bestowal of the white kesa, the granting of the white kesa, really mean? What's the significance of ritually requesting ordination? Perhaps we could spend a whole weekend, maybe a whole order convention, exploring the different elements of the ordination ceremony. But what has struck me perhaps most of all during these last years has been the verses of acceptance. Apparently, Bhante underlined their importance when he last performed a public ordination a few years ago. Especially, he underlined the importance of the verse concerning harmony. harmony with friends and brethren, harmony between order members. I believe that this subject has been covered before, these four acceptance verses, some years ago on a WBO day. And I believe that recently one of the regional order weekends covered the same ground. And I think there was a Brighton regional order weekend or order gathering where the verses of acceptance were explored. So that's really good. Maybe it's been covered in other areas as well. But I think it's one of those subjects you can't cover too much, really. Whenever I recite the verses in the ceremony, or when I give a talk on the subject, and I've given a few talks on the verses of acceptance recently in different contexts, I'm personally reminded of what I am supposed to be doing as an order member, as a dharmachari. I remind myself of my vows. That's what it seems to me. One of the great curses of being a prathojana, a worldling, is forgetting. I forget my purpose. So when I contemplate these verses, I remember my purpose. I remember my vows. I remember my aspirations. I remember the spirit in which Bante gave me ordination, the spirit in which I received ordination. So I hope a weekend devoted to the acceptance verses will have this effect on everybody, a remembering of what we have undertaken. Just recently, Bante was here. He was here on a men's event giving a talk. It was wonderful to have him here for the weekend. And I asked him what the origin of the acceptance verses were. And he told me, as I'd guessed, he composed them. They were his composition. And so we're dealing very much with Bante's vision of ordination. That Bante's vision of what an order member does, of how an order member lives. We're not going to be looking at all the verses in the same kind of detail. Only one of the verses I want to go into in a fair bit of depth. That is, for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. It seems somehow important to look more at that one. Attaining enlightenment is, after all, why we're all here. After all, the Buddhist tradition, of which our order is a part, emanates from the Buddha's enlightenment. And if a Buddhist life is to have any real meaning, it is a life orientated towards enlightenment, towards Bodhi, towards Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, supreme and perfect enlightenment. Enlightenment is the pole star of our lives. Sometimes enlightenment is a subject that people can shy away from, maybe wisely. They can be overawed by it, and that's in many ways an appropriate response. But we have accepted our ordination for the attainment of enlightenment, nothing less. So if that is to have any meaning, we need to be conscious of what it means, of what it means to us. So tomorrow night I'll talk about that particular verse for the attainment of enlightenment, as well as the last of the acceptance verses in less detail, that is, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. Tomorrow night's talk, the notes are looking quite thick. They've been piling up. And it might be that I'll cut it and we'll continue on Sunday morning. We'll just have to see how that goes. And if people are getting bored or falling asleep or it's too much, we'll just have another talk on Sunday morning. I'll play that by ear. For the rest of this evening, I want to talk about the first two acceptance verses. And the aim of this talk is really to stimulate discussion in the groups. There isn't a lot of time for discussion, but not just to stimulate discussion, but to stimulate people's thinking on the subject. Maybe not just discussion here, but discussion when you go back to chapters and so on. I really want to stimulate a greater awareness of what are really different dimensions of spiritual life. I think that's what the four verses amount to. So let's look at the first one. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. So who are my teachers? Notice that it's plural. Who are the teachers? Well, there are what we can call distant teachers and near teachers. There's teachers of the past and teachers of the present. The first teacher is, of course, the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni, who he is the Sutta, the teacher. I think that word Sutta is only used for Shakyamuni. It's not used for any other teacher in Buddhist tradition. He is Sutta Deva Manusa, the teacher of gods and men. He is the first teacher, the first man in this world system, in this world age, to have not only rediscovered the Dharma, but to have attained, enlightenment, but he was the first man to have made it known, communicated it, taught it to others. And I remember when Bhante used to perform ordinations, I seem to recall that he always used to say, before he gave the refuges, he always used to say, well, before the refuges comes the salutation to the Buddha, you know, Namo Tassa, Bhagavato, etc. And he said that comes before the refuges, because first of all, we need to salute the Buddha, because he is the teacher. He is the originator of this whole tradition of going for refuge to the three jewels. The refuges come from him. So going for refuge finds expression, first of all, in loyalty to the Buddha. We are loyal to him because we have faith in him. By faith, of course, I don't mean belief. By faith, I mean resonating with him, with his attainment, our potential enlightenment, resonating with his actual enlightenment. He is our teacher because he embodies what we can become. He shows us what we can be. When we see this, we will be loyal to the Buddha, to what he stands for, but also loyal to what he actually teaches. So we will be loyal to his Dharma, particularly to his basic, his core teachings, which of course means being loyal to those teachings means knowing them, understanding them, but of course making them a living experience as well. I don't need to remind you and itemize what the basic teachings are. I'm sure you all know them all. So we will rely on such teachings, and we won't rely on non-Buddhist teachers and teachings. It's interesting to note that in all the great Buddhist traditions of any school, they always say that one of the first signs of someone who's gone for refuge to the Buddha is giving up reliance on other teachers and the gods. It's listed in many a place in Buddhist tradition, almost like a sort of maxim. He who goes for refuge gives up his reliance on the gods, Mahadeva, Brahma, and so on. Gives up his reliance on the Tirthakas, it's often translated as the heretical teachers. The Buddha is our teacher. That's not to say that our life, our spiritual life, cannot be enriched by all kinds of non-Buddhist traditions, religious and cultural. Bhante has made that abundantly clear to us. But our refuge, our reliance, is on our teacher, the Buddha, and his teachings. He is our refuge. And this is why Shakyamuni, the Buddha, sits at the centre of our refuge tree. Because Bhante's vision of the Dharma has as its basis, its root, the Buddha and his basic teachings. So we are loyal to the Buddha and his Dharma. Bhante was saying to me recently, I think it was in a Shabda report, noticing an older member saying that they didn't have any feeling for the Buddha. And amongst other things, they didn't have any feeling for. And he said he did think that was really odd, that there was apparently no relationship to enlightenment. He thought that was really rather odd. But there are other teachers too, of course. There isn't just the Buddha, there are other teachers too. There are the great teachers of the Buddhist tradition, all of them followers of the Buddha, who have drawn out different aspects of the Buddha's original Dharma. Francis particularly emphasised the teachers that appear on our refuge tree. He has directed us towards them, to the great Indian, Tibetan, Chinese and Japanese teachers. All of those teachers stand for different dimensions of Shakyamuni's original Dharma. So in the order, we are loyal to the entire Buddhist tradition. This is why Bhante has spoken of the order as an ecumenical order, not in the sense of just mixing up teachings into a sort of mess, but in the sense of realising that the Dharma is essentially one, and that the different schools of Buddhism are all expressions of that one transcendent Dharma. This is a vision very particular to Bhante, I think, particularly in these times. Very particular to him. It's what he calls in the survey the transcendental unity of Buddhism. So the Western Buddhist order, the Trilokyabodhi Mahasangha, as we know, is not Theravadin, it's not Zen, it's not Tibetan Nyingmapa, or Gelugpa, or Kagyupa. It's not a Pure Land tradition. It's just Buddhist, inspired by the entire Buddhist tradition. Recently, Bhante's been encouraging some of us to explore Chinese Buddhism more. He thinks there's much that we can learn from the Chinese expression of the Dharma. So we're loyal to the Buddhist tradition. But there are teachers, of course, nearer to us than the great teachers of Buddhist history. There's Bhante's teachers, who indeed are a presence within the order. So many people seem very inspired by the lives of Bhante's teachers. One of Bhante's teachers is actually present here, now, at Padmaloka. Dada Rinpoche's relics are enshrined in the stupa outside. And the tradition is that that means that in some way he is actually present. It's not a sort of memorial to him, but in some mysterious way he is present. And I can say for myself, since we've had the enshrinement of the relics in the stupa, that we do. Many of us feel the presence of Dada Rinpoche very, very strongly, especially when we're performing puja to the stupa. So we're loyal to Dada Rinpoche and his wonderful example of bodhisattva activity. And nearer still, there is Bhante, Urgyen Sangharakshita. He is the nearest teacher to us on the refuge tree. He is there because he is our gateway into the Dharma. He sits where he does quite simply because he has communicated the Buddhist tradition to us. He has translated the Dharma for us in a form which we can actually use, which we can live by. So with loyalty to my teachers means having loyalty to Bhante. And again, I must stress, this must not be a blind loyalty, but a loyalty born of knowledge and experience. Knowledge and to some extent experience of his distinctive presentation of the Dharma. We need to know what he's drawn out, what he's emphasised, why he's drawn it out, why he's emphasised it. We need to put into practice the teachings that he's transmitted to us. Of course, this is not a matter of thinking of Bhante's presentation of the Dharma as a kind of Buddhist or FWBO or TBMSG catechism, which we sort of, you know, just learn parrot fashion and recite. So chance would be a fine thing, but I think you know what I mean. Bhante's presentation of the Dharma arises from a vision of the Dharma. So it's a vision in the end that we need to intuit for ourselves through study and understanding and experience of what he's actually taught. To be loyal to Bhante's teachings means studying them and reflecting upon them and, of course, living by them. And it means sticking to what he has taught, persisting with what he has taught, and not, in difficult times, casting around for other teachers. I know some people, probably most people outside of the order, feel uneasy about this, feel uneasy about this emphasis. Is this cultish? Oh dear, are we part of some cult, Sangharakshita cult? Is it being dogmatic? But it's neither. If you're serious about following the Dharma, For many, many years, you need to follow a particular system of Buddhist practice. This is understood throughout the Buddhist world. I think all teachers would go along with that. You need to study and follow a specific system of Buddhist practice. You need to stick with it and stay with it. You need to go down into it deeply and thoroughly. I believe there's a Zen saying which goes something like, if you want to fill the bucket, drop the bucket right down into the well and don't draw it up too quickly. So give yourself to a specific path of practice for years and years and years on end. This is something we stress very strongly in the ordination process. Be sure that you want to follow Bhante's approach to the Dharma, because ordination is given assuming that you want to do that. If you want to do other things, that's fine, but do all that, sort that out long before ordination. We assume that you want to follow the path as taught by Sangharakshita. There's another point that's just come to my mind here. Of course, Bhante's our teacher in another way. It's not just to do with his teaching. It's to do with him being an exemplar. He's an exemplar in so many ways. But it was brought home to me this weekend just what an exemplar he is. And there's one particular quality that I saw last weekend, and that is Bhante's equanimity. Equanimity is something I must say I haven't always had a feeling for. But Bhante came here, and as you know, his sight has gone. He can't see very well. He came here and gave a talk for an hour and 20 minutes. It was his first long talk, his first public appearance. And I also had quite a bit of time alone with Bhante throughout the weekend and seeing him with various people. What was striking was that he's just the same. I don't mean just the same in that he's not changing, I don't mean like that. But it's the same clarity, the same positivity, the same warmth, the same playfulness, the same sharpness of mind. In fact, in his talk, he talked about losing his eyesight and how a number of people had written to him and saying what a terrible thing this must be for Bhante because he can't read anymore. And he said in his talk, well, it hasn't been terrible for me. He said it's something of a relief, actually. I don't have to read all those books. And he said he's just very, very happy to reflect and be sort of centred more within himself. And he said it was as if Mother Nature was giving him a little teaching, saying, come on, Sangharakshita, you've read enough. You need to reflect more. And he said this with such charm and such grace. And, well, my faith in Bhante was just, my loyalty to Bhante just increased, just became stronger, just seeing an example of somebody with real, deep equanimity. A wonderful thing to see. So he's a teacher for us because he embodies the teaching to some extent. To a great extent, he embodies the teaching for us. Of course, there are other teachers in the order other than Bhante, and particularly there are, for those not ordained by Bhante, your private and public preceptors. For those ordained by Bhante, Bhante is your preceptor. And Bhante told me recently that the teachers he had specifically in mind, primarily in mind, was one's preceptors. And he said, it's fortunate I put teachers because nowadays, mostly people have two preceptors, a private and a public preceptor. Before I say a little about that, about our preceptors, I just want to note that I am aware that I'm speaking to a gathering of order members who are in very different circumstances with regard to their preceptor. Many of you have been ordained by Bhante. Many of you, your private preceptor and public preceptor are the same. If you haven't been ordained by Bhante, you have the same one. Many of you have private and public preceptors who are different. It would be too complicated to try to do an exposition according to each and every circumstances. So my points will be general, and I hope they'll be useful. Apply them to your circumstances. So the essence of the relationship with the preceptor Well, I wrote relationship and I said, no, let's not use that word. It says here, no, let's not use that word. Let's say bond. The essence of the bond with one's preceptor is, of course, going for refuge. At the time of one's ordination, one's preceptor witnesses the fact that we are going for refuge. He sees directly that we are effectively going for refuge. There is indeed a resonance between our going for refuge and his going for refuge. But of course, it has a special significance, a special weight, because our preceptor is someone who we respect, someone who we may even revere, not blindly, of course, but because of our experience of them. Not only that, the preceptor is not acting just on his own. Yes, his response is individual and direct, but the ordination takes place within this whole network of spiritual friendships, this whole network of trust and confidence that we call the order. Because of this, ordination creates a very strong bond between you and your preceptor. It creates a very strong bond between you and Bante, even if you're not ordained by Bante, because Bante is the preceptor of your preceptor. And indeed, it creates a very strong bond because of all the links with the whole order. The preceptor, as it were, stands for the order when he ordains you. And I certainly felt that there was a bond created with Bante at the time of my ordination. In those days, I was well into the Tantra, at least reading about it, trying to do lots of mind-rotting things as well. But one of the things I was always very struck by was this word samaya, meaning bond or oath. And I felt very strongly that at the time of my ordination, a bond, a very strong bond was created with Bante, which I had to honour. He didn't speak of it like that to me, but that's the way I felt it. That's the way I experienced it. Come what may, that bond, I had to honour that bond. I had to honour that link. Being loyal to one's preceptor means, of course, staying in touch with him, discussing your life with him, discussing your practice with him, letting him know what's going on in your life, opening up to him, confessing to him when you need to. It means trusting in him. It means discussing major life decisions with him. This is especially important in the first few years after ordination. And this is especially important, of course, in relation to the private preceptor, because he really acts as one's personal spiritual teacher. And of course, the preceptor should also provide uplift and inspiration. It should be someone you can go to, just to be around. You find it uplifting. It reminds you of your ordination. Of course, this places an enormous responsibility on preceptors. Jolly good thing too. Of course, most important of all, the essence of the matter, it means being loyal to the Dharma. It means being loyal to the going for refuge, to the three jewels, as taught by Bante and as witnessed by your preceptor. The bond with the preceptor, the bond with Bante, is a very strong and important bond. And I know, I've seen, when it is affected in some way, it has a very undermining effect on one's practice. I've seen this in the order. If there are any doubts, if there are any difficulties, it's very, very important to resolve them and to try them to sort them out quickly, if possible. And it's certainly not a good idea to go to another teacher without trying to sort things out first. Not out of any irrational reason, it just doesn't seem to work. If you haven't sorted things out, if you haven't, as it were, got the blessings of your teacher now to go somewhere else without having sorted things out, I don't think you can take up another path cleanly. A good story about this, of course, is Marpa and Milarepa. There was a point in Milarepa in his training with Marpa when he got so fed up that he ran off to another teacher. Marpa's wife, Dag Mema, gave him some relics and said, go off and find another teacher. So off he ran. and received some Dzogchen teachings. And the teacher was really puzzled that it wasn't working, that Milarepa wasn't getting any success. And then it turned out that, well, no, he hadn't Marpa's blessing. So there was something deeply unresolved in Milarepa. So how could taking up that other tradition work? So, of course, this kind of relationship, this bond with the preceptor, as I've said, means that preceptors have a tremendous responsibility. And I think it's particularly important to understand that loyalty does not mean subservience. Bhante actually said quite definitely to me when I was discussing this particular one of the acceptance vows that by loyalty he means being faithful to the bond between you, but not, it doesn't mean subservience. It doesn't mean that you can't argue with your preceptor. It doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything he says. I'm really pleased to say that because I say absolute rubbish sometimes. And I'm really glad that people I've ordained don't agree with me or don't listen to me and realise that I'm talking rubbish, or we'd be in a terrible mess. And it definitely doesn't mean that your preceptor will be telling you what to do. You know, yeah, go, no, now you should leave here and go there. That's not what's meant by it. It's being loyal to the bond. It's very interesting, I think, this business of loyalty, because for many years it was quite a big issue for me, because as many of you know, I lived through the bad days in Croydon, which had their good moments, and I was very loyal to Padmaraja. But I'd say I was, looking back, the loyalty was blind. What was interesting about it was one of the things where the sort of dust fell from my eyes was realising that I felt all right about arguing with Bhante, because I used to have a lot of arguments with Bhante in those days, usually trying to defend Padmaraja. I felt all right about arguing with Bhante because I knew that he wouldn't cut off from me, wouldn't reject me, wouldn't push me away. I was very frightened of arguing with Padmaraja, because if you argued, you were usually sent to Coventry, to the outer darkness. That's what it was like. I hope I've moved on since then. But I do find it quite interesting that loyalty does not mean that you can't argue, though of course you argue in an intelligent and courteous way. You can be in disagreement, but you don't have to be disloyal. So a preceptor has a great responsibility in relation to the person being ordained. And of course, there's a great responsibility when you've been ordained to keep loyal, to keep faithful with the bond with your preceptor. There are, of course, other teachers than this. There are our Kalyanamitras. Many order members have Kalyanamitras. It's interesting, a really interesting feature over the last few years is even quite senior order members asking more senior order members to be their Kalyanamitras. They want that sort of vertical element in their lives because, I suppose, Bhante isn't so readily available to them. There are meditation teachers, some very fine meditation teachers in our order. There are some fine speakers, fine study group leaders. In fact, in one way or another, every order member is a teacher. Not, I hope, in a self-conscious, quasi-professional, role-playing sort of way. Bhante said, apparently, although I haven't heard it from his lips, there are no teachers in the order, in a sense. And I think I can see what he's getting at. And I must say, personally, I'm sort of uneasy about the word teacher, except in the acceptance verse and the way I've been talking about it there. You know, sometimes people say, well, I've done lots of teaching. I'm doing a lot of teaching. And sometimes I'm just a little bit uneasy about it. And I suppose it's because there's such a danger of slipping into a role, of the role of teacher. Order member equals teacher. But putting it more positively, there are no teachers in the order, perhaps, because we have a different vision of spiritual life. We have a vision of a spiritual community pervaded, characterised by Kalyanamitrata. Any teaching, any kind of teaching mode, is nothing other than an expression of spiritual friendship. Spiritual friendship is primary, I would say, teaching is secondary. Teaching is just a mode of Kalyana Mitrata, a mode even of friendliness. So I take also the verse, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination, as meaning not only to describe our relationship to our preceptors, our relationship to Bhante and so on, and to specific order members who we regard as our teachers, I think it also indicates an attitude of being willing to learn, of being willing to be taught, being eager for training, as Shantideva puts it, which of course means putting ourselves in situations where we will be taught and forming the attitude of wanting to be taught. In that sense, we can learn from any and every order member, regardless of how long they've been ordained. And the learning surely never ends. If we think we have no more to learn, if we aren't eager to learn, then surely we're in danger of individually and collectively grinding to a halt. So before concluding these thoughts on the first of the acceptance verses, I'll just say, although it probably doesn't need to be said, that I take it as read that being loyal to our teachers includes standing by them in times of difficulty and defending them when they're criticised or vilified or misrepresented. It means treating them as we treat anybody, with courtesy and respect. So that's the first of the acceptance verses. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. The second acceptance verse goes, in harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. One of the things that's very striking about public ordinations is the degree of harmony that pervades the occasion. I've performed or attended public ordinations here at Padmaloka, at Guhyaloka, at our retreat centres in India, and they're wonderfully harmonious and joyous occasions. Here at Padmaloka, many non-Buddhists have attended our ordinations, usually relations and friends of the people being ordained. And they too comment on the atmosphere. They're part of that atmosphere. They're very moved by that atmosphere. I remember when I first performed a public ordination, which was here at Padmaloka, a number of non-Buddhist people present were clearly very deeply moved by the occasion. They really seemed to resonate with what was happening. And it occurred to me later that it was as if the ordination was giving people something like Siddhartha's fourth sight, a kind of modern version of the sight of the wandering holy man. It was as if people saw the men being ordained as entering a spiritual path. And although they might not want to do that themselves at the moment, they related to it, they respected it. So the harmony on those occasions seemed to be brought about by the ordination, by going for refuge. Everybody in their different ways seemed to see something in one another deeper than their own separate personality. So the harmony was easy and, of course, joyous. It also has to be said that on those occasions, people had a vision of a harmonious spiritual community. And I think vision is the right word. They saw the harmony between the preceptors and the people being ordained. They saw the delight that all the order members present had at seeing another person join them in the order. People find harmony very, very attractive. Very appealing. I think we shouldn't underestimate this. I've been in so many situations, and I particularly think of situations in India where people were so attracted by the harmony, the good feeling going on, the genuine good feeling going on between a group of order members. This usually seemed to happen when we gave public programs, public talks. I suppose harmony is so attractive because it's not that common. It's a rare commodity in this day and age. Of course, harmony, being in harmony, isn't just a nice thing to have going on in our lives. I think it's not too far-fetched to say that it's the goal of the spiritual life. All the greed, all the violence, all the hate, all the division that goes on arises, of course, because of that fundamental ignorance. An ignorance that divides everything up into grasper and grasped, self and other, subject and object. An enlightened being, we're told, makes no such distinction. He sees, using the language of the Avatamsaka Sutra, the perfect interpenetration of all things, of all beings, of all people. Everything is in harmony. In that sutra, the world that the Buddha sees is described in terms of intersecting beams of different coloured lights. All the lights have their own particular colour, but they all intersect. There is no opposition. So for a Buddha, or indeed for someone who has made progress on the path, it said, harmony is his delight. He exults in harmony. He is passionately fond of harmony. He utters speech that makes for harmony. So the acceptance verse, in harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination, means that as an order member, we will do all that we can to maintain and develop the harmony of the order. Do all that we can to heal disharmony when we come across it. Do all that we can to bring people together. This means maintaining and developing and taking on to greater levels our friendships, our existing friendships with other order members. Because, as we know, the order is nothing but a network of friendships. It means keeping those friendships in good repair, watching out for the enemies of friendship, suspicion, mistrust, and so on. But more than that, it means, I think, coming together with order members who aren't our close friends. Order members, well, large gatherings of order members such as this. This sort of gathering, a National Order Weekend, is especially important to the harmony of the order. We're coming together with many different kinds of order members. Just looking around the room, I don't know how many you are, but however many you are, that is the number of different kinds of order members there are. There's a very broad range of order members here this weekend. And the order that Bhante has found is extremely broad, broader than ever, and it's getting broader. It encompasses so many different lifestyles, so many different age groups, so many different kinds of experience, backgrounds, so many different cultures, nations, continents. It's incredible. Bhante's vision of the order is very bold. Let's make no mistake. It's a very bold vision, even a very courageous thing to start an order that is going to encompass so many different kinds of people, so many different lifestyles and so on. And of course, it arises from his own conviction, his very deep conviction, that any human being is capable of communicating with any other human being. I mean, sometimes, I'm really glad I put that in the talk, because sometimes I find myself thinking, well, you know, I can't get on with him because, well, you know, he's that kind of type. He's that kind of temperament. I mean, that's a complete cop-out now, as I stand here and say those words that Bhante has said, that any human being is capable of communicating with any other human being. I sometimes wonder if that conviction sort of arises from that initial insight he had into the Dharma when he read the Diamond Sutra, with all its emphasis on, you know, emptiness and so on. On a weekend like this, we get a glimpse of the range of the order. It's only a little glimpse, because actually the order is much more various than even this weekend. But we get a glimpse of the order's variety. And it becomes clear, then, that harmony is not about uniformity. It's not about all being the same and living the same way. It's something much, much deeper than that. It's about intuiting in one another each other's shraddha, each other's unique faith in the three jewels. Unique faith, and yet it's the same faith. Because if it's faith, it's to some extent transcending our individual peculiarities. The sort of same, but it's different. Of course, this is a practice in itself. This is why the order is a practice in itself. Because we find ourselves with people who in the normal course of life we would avoid. In the normal course of life, we're thrown together with people in the order who in the normal course of life we would walk away from. If we hadn't become Buddhists, we wouldn't have anything to do with them. I know order members who've said that they went to the centre, very close friend of mine, he went to his first centre, opened the door and he thought, hippies. This was many years ago. And he said, worse still, middle class hippies. Absolute anathema to him. Fortunately, Banti was around and a few other people who he found very reassuring. But, you know, we might end up in a chapter with somebody who in the normal course of life, if we hadn't become Buddhists, we wouldn't have wanted anything to do with. But there they are in the chapter. Or in a discussion group on an order weekend with somebody that we wouldn't really like to have anything to do with. You might even the speaker, even me, you might not have wanted anything to do with in the normal course of life, course of your life, if you hadn't countered the Dharma and so on. People who report into Shabda, you know, you might read, you know, a Shabda reporting in and something, you think, you know, look. you know, we kind of, there are people that we don't like, they get on our nerves, whatever. The thing is, the beautiful thing is, and the really irritating thing is, you can't leave the order. Or you don't want to leave it. You can, but you don't want to. And of course, you can't ask them to leave. Can you? You can't say, look, please go, because I don't like you. You know, there they are, meditating every day, very devoted to Banji. So look, sorry, I don't like you because you leave. But it might be... Anyway, yes, you can't do that. So we have to, we're sort of forced... coming together to develop a deeper understanding of one another, a deeper understanding of ourselves, and a deeper understanding of the Dharma. I think it's Aloka used to say that he thought order weekends were really good because it gets you out of positive ruts, even positive ruts, not to speak of negative ones. I think this was in response to an order member who said, well, I don't like coming on order weekends because it breaks up my routine. And Aloka said, well, that's the whole point. The whole point is to break up your routines, you know, because you get habitual, you get kind of, you know, can imagine him saying it. Well, yeah, it's the whole point. You know, because we identify, you know, well, my life, this is the Dharma, this is going for refuge to the three jewels, this is Buddhism, this is the order. But of course, you know, it isn't just that. You know, it isn't just that at all. So this is why we come on order weekends. So... the kind of harmony we're talking about can't be achieved quickly and easily, necessarily. What we're trying to achieve doesn't come about either through pretending everything's all right and we're all getting on when manifestly we're not. Although neither does it mean always arguing and thinking, you know, that opposition is true friendship. Well, sometimes opposition can just be opposition. Opposition after opposition after opposition. And that's no good at all. Harmony and music, I think, is a really good analogy. I think Maitreyi went into this in quite a bit of detail when she spoke about this particular verse. Because, you know, harmony is, you know, harmonies that come about, they, in really good music, you know, are sort of wonderful resolutions of quite complex things going on. I'm sure our musicians here could explain it all to us. But really good harmony seems to come out of difference. Difference seems to be part of harmony somehow. I'm a great fan of Qawwali, Indian Sufi devotional music. And I went to a really good Qawwali a few months back. And it was a fantastic, the pounding rhythm, the different voices, the many, many different voices that were going on, the clapping that was going on, the tremendously fast rhythms, the common devotion. And occasionally these incredible harmonies coming sometimes out of what sounded like a sort of chaos. Incredible, incredible. Well, that's what I think the spiritual community should be like a really good Qawwali group. Harmony is, of course, essential for the exploration of the Dharma that we are conducting together. We mustn't think that the order is a fixed thing. It's alive, it's dynamic. It changes. It changes because we change. It changes because circumstances change. The order that I entered in 1976 has long gone. The order has changed enormously, and it will continue to change enormously. In some ways, it's the same. In many ways, it's completely different. We have to remember that we're in the very early days of Buddhism's arrival in the modern age. We're primitive modern Buddhists. I'm using the word modern because I want to word just the word Western, modern. We're primitive modern Buddhists, archaic modern Buddhists. They'll probably write, you know, history books, Buddhist history books about us in years to come, about the kind of archaic phase. So there's much to explore together, much that is unknown, much that we have to discover. I think there's no better description of what the order should be than Imbanti's description of the meaning of going for refuge to the Sangha in the meaning of conversion in Buddhism. I'll give you a summary of the main points. Those who go for refuge to the Sangha have a common spiritual teacher or spiritual ideal and a common teaching or spiritual principle. And this tends to draw them together, even on the social plane. But what does one mean by together? One does not just mean physical proximity or agreement on doctrinal questions, or even the attainment of the same stages of the spiritual path. It is rather more subtle than that. The together lies in communication, which is not just an exchange of ideas, but a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common spiritual ideal and a common spiritual principle. It is a common exploration in complete harmony and complete honesty of the spiritual world. In this way, spiritual progress takes place. It's that last section that is particularly vivid. When we accept our ordination, we are undertaking to commit ourselves to such a vital mutual responsiveness, to such a harmonious and honest exploration of the spiritual world with other members of the Sangha, with other members of the order. It goes without saying as well that the more basic aspects of developing harmony are essential to all this. Basic aspects such as speaking truthfully, but also kindly, courteously, even gently and respectfully to our fellow order members. It goes without saying that such harmony requires us not to backbite and gossip and turn people against one another and to speak harshly and blindly and be blindly critical of others. Following the Buddha, we make harmony our delight. We exult in harmony. We become passionately fond of harmony, uttering speech that makes for harmony. So, that's some thoughts on the second of the acceptance verses. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. Thank you very much.